Listener advisory. The following program deals with adult themes related to human sexuality. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. This week, we'll hear more from historian Thaddeus Russell, author of A Renegade History of the United States. Last week, Russell showed that whatever leisure time is enjoyed by average people today was gained for them by renegades. This leisure includes weekends off from work, vacations, and the like. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the elite and their tools in the establishment were committed to working everybody else to death. The renegades were low-status, underpaid commoners who simply took time off from work without asking permission. These included black slaves, drunken craftsmen, low-paid factory workers imported from Europe, and other slackers. Yes, it was the slaves who established the practice of vacations, simply by walking away from the plantation for a few weeks or months, then agreeing to return in exchange for not being punished. That was an interesting story, and this week's is even better. Russell argues that many of the rights held by American women today were not won by the suffragists or the early feminists. And the personal freedoms enjoyed by women today were decidedly not won by the suffragists and early feminists, who often actively campaigned against them. No, these rights and freedoms were won by another class of renegades, prostitutes, which the 19th century had in abundance. So both men and women can thank the ladies of the evening for the current ability to purchase contraceptives, to enjoy oral sex, to dance in public, to wear attractive clothes, to have interracial intimacy. And women in particular can thank the hookers for many other elements of women's political, economic, and social liberation. Thaddeus Russell tells a fascinating, rollicking good story here. And after a brief musical introduction, let's let him tell it. And it's a teenage sadness that Bill One has got to taste. And in between age madness that you know it can erase. Till she sees your face.
So at the very same time that white slackers and shiftless slaves were inventing American leisure, some very bad women were inventing women's liberation. And I'm not talking about feminists. In the 19th century, a woman who owned property, who made high wages, who had sex outside of marriage, who performed or received oral sex, who used birth control, who consorted with men of other races, who danced, who drank, or walked alone in public, who wore makeup, perfume, or stylish clothing, and most importantly, was not ashamed of any of those things, was almost certainly a whore. In fact, prostitutes won virtually all of the freedoms that were denied to women but are now taken for granted. Women who chose prostitution enjoyed a very favorable market for their labor. Demand, of course, was always enormous and constant, and the pool of available labor was kept small by the stigma that was attached to the trade. So even the poorest paid prostitutes, the so-called streetwalkers, these were the women who weren't even attached to brothels, who simply walked the streets by themselves, even those women at the lowest, at the bottom of the trade, earned at least five times what the average woman worker made in a so-called legitimate profession. The United States Department of Labor got very concerned about this, and in 1916 they conducted a study of prostitution, and they found that on average prostitutes earned $40 per week. This is in 1916. How much money was that? It was exactly double what white male trade union construction workers made. The high wages of prostitutes made them not only the wealthiest women in the United States, it also made them the only economically independent women in the country. Prostitutes were the first women in this country to break free of what early American feminists, I think, rightly described as a system of female servitude. Of course, wages in respectable positions for women were so low that the only way a woman could gain any real wealth was by marrying a rich man, right? But because of the law of coverture, something that most Americans are now no longer aware of, which granted legal ownership of all property to husbands, even women who married wealthy men owned little or nothing of their own. But women who chose to be bad could live well with no help at all from a man. Prostitutes who rose to the top of the industry to become madams owned more wealth by far than any other women in the United States. In fact, they were among the wealthiest people in the United States. One example is Jessie Hayman, a very prominent madam in San Francisco. In fact, you can still go see her, the building in which her brothel was housed in the Tenderloin District in downtown San Francisco. Her brothel included three fireplaces, a saloon, a champagne cellar, and 15 suites that were filled with imported French furniture. She provided each one of her employees with a wardrobe worth a total of $6,000. This is in early 20th century dollars. I don't know exactly what that translates to, but it's huge. Each wardrobe included a fox fur coat, 4 tailored suits, 8 hats, 2 dress coats, 12 pairs of shoes, 12 pairs of gloves, 7 evening gowns, and 7 negligees. Hayman earned enough money from her business to buy several parcels of extremely valuable land in the city, and then she was so wealthy that after the 1906 earthquake that decimated the city, she and several other madams provided food and clothing to thousands of people who were left homeless. Lou Graham. Does anyone know Lou Graham? Okay. The queen of the lava beds. She was Seattle's most prominent and wealthiest madam. She was also, without a doubt, one of Seattle's wealthiest residents overall. She invested heavily in the stock market and in real estate, and she became one of the largest landholders in the entire Pacific Northwest. Now, I don't want to romanticize prostitution. It was certainly not paradise to be a prostitute. Some madams abused their employees. Some of them placed them in peonage. But those madams tended to be failures. Why? Because of the very tight labor market. To attract women in the very competitive markets, especially in Western boomtowns, where the demand for prostitutes was always intense, most madams not only paid their employees far higher wages than they would find in any other employment, they also typically provided free birth control, free health care, free legal assistance, free housing, and free meals for their employees. Very few Americans of either sex in the 19th century, and even today, enjoyed such benefits. Now, you're probably wondering, well, what did the prostitutes themselves think about this? And we have some answers to that question. And some of the answers might surprise you. In 1859, a very prominent doctor in New York City named William Sanger conducted a poll, a survey of 2,000 women who sold sex. And Sanger went into this expecting them to all say, "I became a prostitute because I was destitute." And he was shocked at what he found. Now, roughly half of the prostitutes he interviewed did give him the answers he was expecting. They gave answers such as, to the question he asked them was, "What was the cause of your becoming a prostitute?" Roughly half of them said things like destitution, seduced and abandoned, or ill treatment of parents, relatives, or husbands, or bad company generally. But to Sanger's great horror and surprise, 513 of the women he interviewed said that they, this is more than one quarter, said that they chose their profession in order to gratify their sexual desires. Sanger said that the women who gave this answer revealed what he called an innate depravity, a want of true womanly feeling, which is actually incredible. And then, this is not the entire, there's even more answers that are more surprising. A large number of the women he interviewed did not even see their profession as being work at all. 181 of them stated as their main reason for choosing it, quote, drink and the desire to drink. 124 of them saw prostitution as, quote, an easy life. And then 29 women, and these might be the baddest renegades in all of American history, said that they became prostitutes because they were, quote, too idle to work. The two leading historians of American prostitution have found similar evidence. Timothy Guilfoyle wrote a very important book on prostitution in 19th century New York City. He said, "These women did not view prostitution as deviance or sin. Rather, they considered it a better alternative to the factory or domestic servitude." And Ruth Rosen, who wrote the very first scholarly study of prostitution that was published in 1978, I think it's still the best book on the subject. Rosen said, she was, quote, "struck again and again by most prostitutes' view of their work as being easier and less oppressive than other survival strategies they might have chosen." And actually, the chapter on prostitution was excerpted on Alternet for about a week, and hundreds of people wrote in, and dozens of them were former sex or current sex workers. And they argued, you know, if you think that working, they think of exploiting your body in that way, using your body for sex, rather than being exploited to work on a factory or scrubbing floors, if you think selling your body for sex is worse than selling your body for scrubbing floors, that says something about what you think about sex. And I think they might be right. Prostitutes also undermined virtually every sexual taboo that limited the freedom of women. In 1873, the United States Congress passed the Comstock Act, fairly famous, infamous law. The Comstock Act effectively banned the distribution of birth control. It was in effect until the 1920s. But during that time, an underground army of renegades continued to produce, distribute, and purchase illegally contraceptives and keep sexual freedom alive for all of us. And, of course, the steadiest and largest pool of consumers during that time was prostitutes. By the 1870s, it was estimated, or it is estimated by historians, that 5 to 10% of women in American cities, or several million women, were prostitutes in the 1870s. That's a huge market for birth control when it was illegal. These women kept underground birth control businesses alive until its legalization, until the legalization of contraceptives in the 1920s. The largest manufacturer of illegal contraceptives during this period, during those decades, was a man named Julius Schmid. He was a German Jewish immigrant who had a house near Times Square. Of course, Times Square had the red light district. And he had an underground factory in which he employed his wife and his children and other workers making condoms and diaphragms. He produced tens, hundreds of thousands of these things over decades, all underground, all illegally. And he had his factory in the right place. Most of his customers were prostitutes. Prostitutes kept that business alive. When legalization came in the 1920s, Schmid became the producer of the best-selling condoms in the United States. So if you have ever used a 4X, Ramses, or Chic condom, you have an unassimilated Jewish criminal and thousands of whores to thank. Prostitutes were the vanguard of the sexual revolution that broke open the erotic lives of Americans. In the 19th century, oral sex was universally condemned as a sin. During that time, brothels were the only place that a man could receive it without coercion, without rape. Until, in fact, well into the 20th century, medical sexual manuals and marriage advice books that sort of instructed couples how to have sex, they either ignored oral sex altogether or they condemned it as being pathological and perverted. As of 1950, fellatio, even when practiced by a married couple, was a felony in all 48 states. And cunnilingus was a felony in 41 states, which might be an indication of early women's liberation, but I'm not sure. No doubt that many Americans practiced oral sex anyway, but the important point here is that prostitutes were practically the only ones who did so publicly and with no apparent shame. This is just one example. There are many studies that show the same thing. In a 1934 survey of Chicago prostitutes, only 5 solicited what investigators called the normal coitus, while more than 100 offered fellatio. Prostitutes also made dancing part of mainstream American culture. Dance historians have estimated that in the 1910s, more than 100 new dances became fashionable in respectable public places in the U.S. These dances radically overturned Victorian conventions against overt sexuality because they, of course, encouraged couples to dance closely with lots of physical contact and to move their bodies in sensual, really sexual ways. The most influential of these new dances were the Turkey Trot, the Foxtrot, the Charleston, and the Texas Tommy. Historians of dance have cited those dances that became respectable in the 1910s as being the basis for swing dance in the 1930s and 40s, for the movements at the first rock and roll concerts in the 1950s, for disco in the 1970s, and for hip-hop. There's wide agreement on that. Those dances were invented by ex-slaves and their descendants in the South, but then they were popularized among whites by prostitutes in the red light district of San Francisco known as the Barbary Coast. Through the 19th century and into the early 20th, prostitutes were virtually the only women in the United States who wore makeup, who colored their hair, or who wore brightly colored clothing. And the red dress was the symbol of the sex trade. It was known as the scarlet shame of streetwalkers. If you wore a red dress in public, you were a prostitute. Respectable women simply never wore a red dress. It was the sure sign of what you did for that what you did for a living was illicit. But by the early 20th century, as more and more women left the countryside and came into cities and discovered new freedoms there, they made elements of the prostitute styles their own. In the first three decades of the 20th century, the number of American perfume and cosmetics manufacturers nearly doubled, and the factory value of their products rose tenfold. At the new dance halls that spread across the cities in the 10s and 20s that became all the rage, the use of rouge, powder, and lipstick was an almost universal custom. A lot of newspapers noted during this time that the wealthiest women in society had also adopted the look of the street. The New York World was somewhat shocked when it reported that, quote, society women now paint their faces, even those in very select circles. And the historian Kathy Pice, who's written the definitive study of the history of cosmetics, said that by the 1910s, it was often difficult to distinguish the dress and style of respectable women from prostitutes at dances. By the middle of the 20th century, the looks that were pioneered by prostitutes were not only respectable, but also completely normal. Massive adoption of their clothing styles began in the 1910s, when, for the very first time, respectable women unabashedly revealed the skin below their necks. Hems became shorter, hosiery was rolled down to reveal parts of the leg, and dresses were deeply cut to expose cleavage. In 1917, the eminently respectable, completely middle-class and bourgeois magazine, The Ladies' Home Journal, advised in its fashion column for women to wear dresses that were sleeveless and semi-transparent. Now, just a few years before then, only a madam would say such a thing. Many observers also noticed that women smoking and drinking in public, which had been the exclusive practice of prostitutes, were becoming fashionable for women of all classes. And then there was the famous short, cropped, sometimes wavy hairstyle that became the fashion statement of the 1920s. That was invented by which group of women? You're supposed to say flappers, and then I say no. There is evidence, in fact, photographic evidence, of prostitutes wearing that style in New Orleans in 1912 and 1913. That style, that flapper style that was actually invented by prostitutes, became so common that it was worn by First Lady Lou Henry Hoover in her official portrait, and by First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt in her official portrait, both of which still hang in the White House. And then there was the scarlet shame of whores, the red dress. What happened to the red dress? Well, as you probably know, it became the symbol of American female respectability. Flash forward many, many years to 2005. Laura Bush unveiled in that year at the White House in a ceremony the First Lady's Red Dress Collection. It was a charity for heart disease. At the inaugural event, Laura Bush spoke on behalf of her six predecessors, and she said this: Mrs. Reagan's love of the color red is well known. Lady Bird Johnson celebrated her 80th birthday in her red evening gown. Betty Ford's and Rosalind Carter's red dresses were reliable favorites. Barbara Bush wore red to a state dinner, accompanied, of course, by her pearls. Hillary Clinton's red dress set just the right tone on Valentine's Day, and I wore my red dress to the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow. We've all made good use of our red dresses. You may or may not know that Michelle Obama became the first lady to appear on the cover of Glamour magazine last year. Guess what she was wearing? Prostitutes were also the pioneers in this country of racial integration. During the height of Jim Crow, this is the period from the late 19th century to the early 20th century, when on average one black man was lynched per day in the South, countless thousands of other black men had sex with white women with impunity in the brothels of the wild towns of the West. In fact, no place on the planet was more integrated, I am convinced, after 10 years of research on this, than the 19th century Western whorehouse, saloon, or dance hall. A lot of residents and travelers in the West during this time reported on what they called the kaleidoscopic social makeup of saloons and dance halls. They also reported frequently on the high incidence of interracial sex, in particular in brothels. So-called black and tans were very common. Black and tans were brothels in which both white and prostitutes were employed, and which catered to both white and black customers. In big Western cities, especially like Denver and San Francisco and L.A., the typical brothel contained not just black and white prostitutes, but also women from China, from Japan, from Mexico, and from all parts of Europe. There were Jewish madams, there were Italian madams, and there were Cherokee madams. Chinese and Mexican madams controlled a large part of the commerce in early San Francisco and early L.A. And then there were many, many wealthy, powerful, and famous madams who had been born into slavery. Now, this is not to suggest at all that prostitutes were committed in any moral way to racial justice, but that, like all good renegades, they were committed to no morality at all. The university researcher conducted a study of prostitutes, and he was particularly interested in the fact that they often crossed the color line when this was not being done outside of their world. And he got very similar answers from white and black prostitutes about why they did this. The white woman he asked said why she had sex with black men for money. She said, "It ain't that I'm so crazy about colored men, but I can make more money here among them." And a black woman said virtually the same thing. She said, "I like to have white trade because they'll pay more, period." You may know about the great migration of African Americans from the South into cities in the North and in the South. In fact, there's a new best-selling book out about this. I'm sure it doesn't mention this part about the great migration. During the great migration, there was another great migration across the sexual color line. In Chicago and New York, police investigators reported frequently on the proliferation of brothels, which explicitly and specifically and loudly and unashamedly sold and marketed the violation of America's greatest taboo. A lot of these establishments catered either to black men seeking white prostitutes or to white men seeking black prostitutes. In 1928, this is decades before the Civil Rights Movement began, this is 1 year before Martin Luther King was even born, undercover investigators of brothels in New York City found racial integration nearly everywhere they looked. One of the most thriving establishments of this kind in New York was a place called Spann's. It was in Harlem. And it advertised itself in newspapers and on its door as a club of, quote, "white women for colored men." Another speakeasy in New York was described by investigators as employing, quote, "white women operated for colored men only." And in Chicago, a black-white club was visited by an undercover investigator, and at that club he found 9 white women, 8 of whom were there in the company of black men. Now, just like their counterparts in the Western boom towns, the proprietors of black-white brothels in the North were pure renegades who cared little for morality. They cared little for social conventions. They cared little for the wishes of the community. One of them put it this way: "We take anybody that has the money." And like all good renegades, I argue in the book, they opened freedoms for countless people. So who were the enemies of these renegades? And who were the enemies of the freedoms that they pioneered? Some of them were the usual suspects. Some of them were the kinds of elite white men you might expect, but others were not. The Founding Fathers waged a relentless attack on what John Adams called the corruption which is prevalent in so many American hearts, a depravity that is more inconsistent with our Republican governments than light is with darkness. The founders wrote pamphlets after pamphlets after books. They gave speeches after speeches extolling the work ethic. They called for Americans to shun non-marital sex of all kinds. One of the leading industries of the early 19th century was for devices that stopped people from masturbating. There was one of the most commonly used devices at the time, promoted by some of the founding fathers, kept women from opening their legs. The founding fathers, especially John Adams, believed that dancing would destroy the republic. Adams was very concerned about this. He wrote a lot about it. They told Americans to resist any clothing that made them look fashionable. Many great capitalists, you may not be, probably are not surprised to hear, in the 19th century upheld the work ethic, of course, for their workers. Thousands of ministers did so as well, and these groups helped create a formal culture in the United States that many have described as being more repressive than Victorian England. But a lot of the figures now known as the people's heroes, the voice of the oppressed, also attacked renegade freedoms and pleasures. A major argument for going to war against the South was to make the region and its slaves less licentious and more productive. Now, just like the abolitionists, early American feminists are often thought of as being proponents of freedom. But feminists in the 19th century, unfortunately, did a lot to punish the renegade women of the time and to squash the freedoms that they created through what was called, and this sort of says it all, the social purity movement. Organizations such as the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the National Purity Association became training grounds for the suffrage movement, and they were enormously powerful lobbying groups between the 1870s and World War I. Ruth Rosen, the historian I cited earlier, put it this way. She said, "Feminism and social purity were very much intertwined, with members of each movement supporting causes of the other." Social purity activists formed vice commissions in nearly every city in the United States. And their stated goal was what they called the absolute annihilation of prostitution. They carried ominous names like the New England Watch and Ward Society, the New York Committee of 14, and my favorite, the Los Angeles Morals Efficiency Committee. In the first two decades of the 20th century, the vice commissions that were led by feminists successfully lobbied police and courts to radically increase prosecution of prostitution. In response to their lobbying, several states built reformatories specifically for prostitutes, in which women were trained to sew and clean and cook to be wives and mothers. Most states during this period passed laws that allowed courts to shut down brothels entirely, board them up, and kick the inhabitants onto the streets. So suddenly, prostitutes were left without the protection of a madam, and most madams before then owned and used guns, and most madams during that time employed police officers to protect their employees. They no longer had that protection. They no longer had the protection of the four walls of the brothels. They were left to deal with hostile cops and sadistic customers all by themselves. So they had nowhere to turn but where? To male criminals. This is when pimps began to dominate the practice of prostitution. So by attempting to banish the sex trade, feminists simply moved it from female power to male power.
A fascinating talk by Thaddeus Russell, with a fascinating conclusion. Who are the real scoundrels, and who are the real reformers? Thanks to Todd Boyle and Mike McCormick in Seattle for the original recording, which I have condensed. Thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and one reminder, be kind to your local streetwalker. She's probably doing as much to protect your freedom as all the troops in Afghanistan, and she's getting thanked for it a lot less. Ciao. Good girls don't